It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strange-Champs. Today, the heart of darkness. Now, there's a question that has been around for a long time. Are humans innately violent? That is, if you strip the civilization out of us, just how bad would we be? So first, we're going to talk about one of the most acclaimed documentaries of the past year, the Academy Award-nominated film, The Act of Killing. It follows a former Indonesian death squad leader as he remembers and even reenacts the atrocities he committed. Charles Monroe Kane talked with American director Josh Oppenheimer, who spent 5 years making this film. And Charles, let's get some background first.
Well, and the film is about what happened in Indonesia in 1965. If you remember, that's when the government was overthrown by a military coup, and this was the U.S.-backed coup that put Suharto in power. But in that process, in less than a year, more than 1 million people were killed, 1 million alleged communists. And to this day, the death squad leaders have never been brought to justice.
So how did Oppenheimer go about making the film?
It's really unique. He did something I've never seen before. He made the film from the point of view of the perpetrators, not the victims. He told me it wasn't hard to find them and that they were everywhere. Everywhere he went, every street corner, he would find them, and they were completely proud to tell the story.
I found to my horror, really, that every perpetrator in the village was immediately boastful about the worst details of the killings, which they would recount with smiles on their faces, often in front of their families, even their small grandchildren. I had this awful feeling that I'd wandered into Germany 40 years after the Holocaust, only to find the Nazis still very much in power. I showed this material back to those survivors who wanted to see it. Not all of them did, but many did. And then to the broader Indonesian human rights community, and everybody said, keep filming the perpetrators. You're onto something so important, because anyone who sees this anywhere in the world will be forced to finally acknowledge the rotten heart of this regime of fear and corruption and theft and plunder that the killers have built and which is still very much in place.
What I think we need to make sure we hear for people who haven't seen this film, this isn't a Talking Heads documentary. They're just not sitting there with a black, you know, background like Ken Burns behind them. You have these guys not only boasting what they did, but you let them act it out in Hollywood genres like John Wayne on horses or old-fashioned gangster films. Josh, where did that idea come from that you'd have these men show you how they kill people, how they torture people? It was incredible.
For 2 years, I filmed every perpetrator I could find across North Sumatra, and all of them were boastful. All of them would, within minutes of meeting me, offer to take me to the places they killed, whereupon when we'd arrive there, they would launch into spontaneous demonstrations of how they killed.
Man.
And complain afterwards that they hadn't thought to bring along, for example, a friend to play a victim or a machete to use as a prop. And so I proposed to them very directly, look, you've participated in one of the biggest killings in human history, and I could be that open with them because they, of course, were that open with me about the fact that they'd killed. I want to know what it means to you and to your society. I would say, you want to show me what you've done, so show me in whatever way you wish, and I will film your reenactments, but also your discussions around them.
It's incredible, because they're wearing, like, Humphrey Bogart hats, and, I mean, one scene, there's a fish that looks like it's about 2 stories tall, and one of the perpetrators is in drag, and there's dancing girls. They're dressed as cowboys. It is so surreal to watch the murders and tortures in that set. And one of the surreal parts of it all, which is good to the heart of any documentary, is a person. His name's Anwar Kongo. Can you tell me how you met him and how he became the central person in your film?
As I mentioned, I spent 2 years filming every perpetrator I could find, and Anwar was the 41st perpetrator I met at the end of that 2-year period. And in many ways, my first encounter with him was like everybody else. I'd been referred to him by other perpetrators who said, by the time I reached Medan, a number of people had started to point to him and say, this was really the most notorious death squad leader or executioner in the city. It's the third biggest city in Indonesia, about the size of Chicago. So it's a big city. And try and film him. So I approached him one day. And when I arrived at his house, there was his wife had guests, and he said, okay, I'm happy to tell you about what we did in the 60s, but why don't I take you to the place we did it, and I'll show you what we did. And he takes me to a roof terrace above what is now a handbag store, but used to be a paramilitary office, a newspaper office, and it was the place where they were torturing and interrogating the opponents of the new military dictatorship. When they were finished interrogating them, they would haul them upstairs and kill them on this roof terrace. And Anwar takes me there and shows me how he went about it, and shows me how he used wire to kill because it was relatively bloodless and easier to clean up. And this was the very first day that I met him. And it's an early scene in the film. And after showing me, he does something in many ways that was typical of a first shoot with a perpetrator, taking me to the place where he's killed, showing me how he killed. There was nothing unique there, even thinking to bring along props. He brings along a wire. That wasn't so unusual. But what was really unusual was what happened next, where he says, you know, I have nightmares from what I've done. I've been trying to forget it. I go out drinking and taking drugs and dancing to forget what I've done. So he acknowledges a trauma, a pain. And then he says, and to forget all of this, I would go out dancing. I'm a good dancer, look. And he starts to dance the cha-cha-cha in the place where he's killed all these people, as though almost to banish the horror that he's just described. And the dancing was one of the most absurd, surreal, grotesque metaphors for what happens when killers win. And I started to wonder, because his pain was right there on the surface, whether perhaps the boasting that so many perpetrators, all the other perpetrators, had indulged in, perhaps that boasting might not be a sign of pride, but might be something much easier to understand, something much more human. I started to wonder whether boasting and remorse are two sides of the same coin.
There's an amazing moment in the film. I'll set it up for our listeners here, where it's about your presence in the film. And Anwar, who we're talking about, he's demonstrating how to decapitate someone. He's an actor, and his neck's already cut, you know, in the Hollywood makeup. And then he stops. You see his face completely change, and he looks to you and says, I know how my victims felt. I know what it would like to be tortured. And you immediately snap back at him and say, no, you don't. No, you don't, because they're all going to die, and you know you're going to live. There are many times in the film you hear someone say, hey, Josh, hey, watch this. Hey, Josh, what do you think? What was your role in the film when you were able to say to someone that you're wrong, to a murderer?
I don't think I was really angry there. I think that I might have been disappointed by his, yet again, when it was clear he was starting at that point in the process to feel some, looked like to me, remorse, that then he tried to run away from it by offering me this kind of easy version of empathy. And so like, oh, now I empathize, I know what it was like. And early in the process, I made a decision that I would not make the leap from saying this man has done something monstrous to this man is a monster. Because the former is true. He has done something monstrous. He's done something terrible. But the latter, that the man is a monster, isn't true. The man's a human being. And if we're going to have any chance of preventing killing, we have to understand it. And to understand killing, we have to look at the human beings who kill and listen to them and try and understand what they experience and why. And I also recognize by condemning him simply and saying this man is a monster, I would be reassuring myself that I'm totally unlike him. And while I would hope if I grew up in his family in 1950s Indonesia with his siblings, with his peer group, with that political context, I would hope that in 1965, at the time of the killings, I would hope I would make different decisions. But I know I'm extremely lucky never to have to find out. And that meant that I had to approach him as a human being.
Right.
And in approaching him as a human being, it meant that I had to be honest with him and build rapport in the way you build rapport with human beings, which is to be honest, ultimately, if you're going to work with someone for years and years and years.
Has he ever brought up to you, or do you bring up to him, issues of redemption, the idea of trying to earn back or at least pay penance for what he's done?
Only really once, when Anwar saw the film and said to me, there's nothing left for me to do with my life than to die. And that was a terrible thing to hear from someone you care for, especially after it's in response to a film that I've made with him and about him. And I said to him, and I guess I didn't use the word redemption, but I said, you know, Anwar, whatever good you do in the rest of your life isn't undermined by the bad things you've done in the past. That's not to say that, you know, in the sort of calculus of justice, he could ever make up for what he's done. But he could live the rest of his life with some meaning. He could do meaningful things with the rest of his life. And I think I was wondering whether he might have the courage to speak out against the killings, to join the sort of human rights community, which has been very mobilized by the film and very energized by the film in speaking out against what has happened and taking some responsibility for it, apologizing for it. He hasn't done that. And I'm not surprised.
What about you? You spent all these years making and hearing all these atrocities, watching all these reenactments of real murders and real tortures and real rape. How did you hold up during all those years filming that? What were your dreams like?
There's a scene where Anwar shows how he might have killed a child by butchering a teddy bear. And it's part of, it's like it starts as a game with Herman dressed as a fat gangster in a fedora and a suit. Herman, Anwar's portly sidekick and protege, playing, improvising as part of his kind of game, the mother of this teddy bear, trying to bribe Anwar, save his own life or her own life in the case of, in the context of the game, by offering her daughter to Anwar. The daughter's just this stupid teddy bear. And Anwar butchers the teddy bear. And I think what was most chilling there is he blames Herman. He says, "You're the real barbarian." He blames the victim. And of course, the whole fantasy of the victim trying to save herself by offering her daughter is a lie in the minds of the perpetrator to help justify what he's done. It's a moment where the film is not giving you any kind of glimpse on what happened, but a glimpse into how the perpetrators justify it in their darkest moments. And when we were shooting that scene, it's really an awful scene, and it's, I think, one of the most important.
It is, it's an awful scene, yeah.
But when we were shooting that scene, Anwar's microphone was rubbing against his suit, and I had to call cut to fix his microphone. And Anwar looked at me and said, "Josh, you're crying." And I felt my face. I didn't know I was crying. It's the only time in my life where I found that I was crying without realizing that I was crying. And I said, "Wow, so I am." And Anwar said, "What shall we do about it?" And I said, "Well, we'll continue shooting the scene," which we did, obviously pushing myself beyond some threshold. I went home that evening feeling utterly tainted. Like in order to deal with the trauma that lurks just below the surface, I've had to immerse myself in it and tainted by it. And that was, in my mind, the beginning of about 8 months of really terrible nightmares, where I would wake up, not be able to sleep for the rest of the night. The next day, I would be afraid of sleeping and have insomnia. The next night, it would start again. That went on for about 8 months. I got through it because of my wonderful Indonesian crew. These are people who remain anonymous still, to protect their safety, and my family. But it is very emotionally impactful. There's no denying that.
You know, Joshua, in the end, after all the surreal reenactments and gut-wrenching admissions and just an intense film, one of the most powerful moments for me in the film was this mundane moment in a car where one of the leaders of the genocide says to you, "Hey, Josh, war crimes are defined by the winners. I'm a winner."
And I get to make my own definition.
And I get to make my own definition of what that means. Did they win?
They won. I mean, that's what the film's about. And it's, Indonesia could now have a popular movement to unseat these guys, perhaps through mobilizing, organizing in the context of the very corrupt, even criminal electoral democracy that Indonesia has today. Things could change. The balance of power could change. The film has certainly provided ammunition for that fight, but nevertheless, the film is the whole raison d'etre of this film. The reason I made it is because it's an expose of what happens when the killers win. And somehow I have this feeling that that's not the exception to the rule. Genocide, we think, okay, the Nazis, we think the Khmer Rouge, they were thrown out of power, there have been tribunals, there's been some form of justice, however incomplete and impartial. But I would suppose that's the exception to the rule, that perpetrators of mass political violence normally win and then normally take power. And that's why they perpetrate the violence. If every time it happened, or most of the times, they have their comeuppance, they wouldn't do it anymore. And then all that's unique in Indonesia, perhaps, is the boasting of the perpetrators. That's an allegory for the rule, a metaphor for the rule. And the reason they boast is simply, it's not just that they won. And this is where it implicates all of us. It's because the rest of the world, at least the Western world, supported them at the time of the killings and have supported them enthusiastically ever since. And they know that. So when they meet a foreigner with a camera, they don't think this is something they should be ashamed of. They boast, and they boast openly.
Joshua Oppenheimer, talking with Charles Monroe Kane about his documentary, The Art of Killing. He's still in touch with Anwar and considers him a friend. The Art of Killing was nominated for a 2014 Academy Award, and it's now available for streaming. I should warn you, it is a very disturbing film. You know, sometimes you have to wonder, is anyone capable of violence? Is brutality bred in our bones? Enter the fierce people. That's what anthropologist Napoleon Chagnon calls the indigenous Yanomamo Indians of the Amazon. His 1968 book about them is one of the best-selling anthropology books of all time. But in the 45 years since he wrote the book, Chagnon has come to a stark conclusion, that the violence and brutality the Yanomamo are famous for is basic human nature. Now, in the anthropology world, that's incredibly controversial, and Chagnon's taken a lot of heat for it. When they talked together, Steve Paulson asked him to take us back to his first contact with the Yanomamo. He was traveling deep in the Amazon with a missionary when they were suddenly surrounded by a group of men with runny noses, all pointing arrows at him. Turned out they were just back from a fight.
The fight didn't happen in the village I was going to, mm-hmm. but the people who lived in that village had gone to the club fight and fought with the men in the other village and got the women back. And the villages were about, you know, 4 or 5 hours apart from each other on foot. Anyway, they had this brutal club fight, and the people that they took the woman back from, on their parting enjoinders, said that next time we come to your village, we're going to shoot you and kill you. So when I walked into the village, they thought it was raiders from the other village coming there to get revenge. And that's why they met us with drawn arrows. And, of course, in the jungle, they didn't, well, yeah, we're expecting the anthropologist to get here any day now.
Did they know you were coming?
No.
So this was a total surprise.
Yeah, it was a complete surprise for
them. This white anthropologist would show up in their village.
Yeah. Anyway, after the dogs stopped yapping and were constrained by their owners, they recognized the missionary who was with me. He came in right behind me, and they were real happy to see him. And they chatted for a while, and then presently they went back to snorting their drugs.
Which, so that's what was causing the mucus pouring down their face?
Yeah, the drugs were a ground powder they mixed with ashes from a particular kind of wood, and then they put the substance in the end of a foot-long hollow tube made from a bamboo, and they would blow it up each other's noses with immense power.
Was this some sort of hallucinogen?
Yes, it was a hallucinogenic drug, and they use it almost every day to chant to their spirits and wage war with the spirits against their mortal enemies on the ground. And so they not only fight with bows and arrows, but they have their spirits fighting as well.
So this must have been a total shock to you.
It was. My enthusiasm for interviewing people and taking notes diminished in proportion to the number of times the brush was rattled to the outside and the men ran up with their drawn bows and arrows to see who was trying to get in.
So how did you communicate with them?
With great difficulty. At first they thought there was something defective about me because I didn't understand their language, and they just assumed that I was hard of hearing. So they began saying things louder to me until they were shouting, and finally they realized that this guy's a bobo. He can't understand it. The single thing we're saying, and so they just gave up on me. But before Barker left, I managed to get a list of phrases in the Yanomamo language translated into English that I could then build on, and that's how I learned the language. Little by little, I would substitute new words I learned into the phrases that Barker had given me, and by the end of about 4 or 5 months, I was able to conduct myself in a relatively efficient fashion, as long as there weren't any sophisticated issues involved. Like, you don't start translating myths of Indians in 6 months, despite what Margaret Mead says.
You had been, you still were at that point, a student in anthropology.
Yes, I was a graduate student in anthropology.
What were the biggest surprises to you?
Well, first of all, in all the readings that I had put under my belt in preparation for doing my field research, you'd read ethnographic reports on tribes of Indians that say the Amazon Basin. They have arrows. They have bows. They make pottery. They make their houses out of vines and thatch. They have warfare. They have cross-cousin marriage. Well, I mean, these neutral things like they have warfare. I mean, you would just, reading it in a book, you'd think, well, that they have warfare, and we have warfare. Well, I hadn't realized what warfare in the flesh actually meant. I mean, these people, they were the last major multi-village tribe of Indians. There were close to 25,000 of them, but nobody knew that, who were still conducting warfare without being interfered with by either the government of Venezuela or the government of Brazil. Most of these people weren't even aware that they were living in some country that had a name like Venezuela.
Now, when you say they conducted warfare, there would, what, be wars between different villages?
Yeah, they fought mostly over women. If you asked a Yanomama, why did such and such a village split into two parts and one part move away at such and such a place, they'd say, women. We fought over women. That's why we split apart. We couldn't live with each other any longer.
When you say they fought over women, it's like one village would raid another village to abduct women?
No, it wasn't quite that simple. It was easier for them to visit a village, a group of men visit a smaller village coming from a larger village, and then take women with them on the way out when they were going home. And, of course, the men would want to get their women back.
Sure.
And they would henceforth and thereafter sneak up on them and raid them, waiting to get one of the men alone outside and shoot him full of arrows, and then flee and go home.
Was this common, this kind of thing?
Yes. One village that I was studying was raided 25 times in the first 17 months I was living there.
Wow.
It had a lot of enemies. It was a big village, but what happens is when you're a big village, you've got a lot of enemies, and if one of them attacks you, that's when all of the other 15 villages who are allied to the first village will jump in, because they know that even if it's a large village, they can't possibly retaliate against a group of dedicated men who are trying to get revenge on previous killings. And so their wars would go on and on and on. And
so there was a kind of a cycle of revenge then.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Until one group would eventually move so far away that it would be impractical for raiders to, you know, walk 4 days to raid them, because they'd have to travel through territory that wasn't theirs, and that's dangerous.
Now, when I was reading your account of this, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, it is so different from our culture. But there's a piece of me that's thinking, they must see that, I mean, this is counterproductive in some way. I mean, you know, you raid another village, they raid back. And, you know, you kill one of theirs and they kill one of yours. And
well,
I mean, there's a kind of a futility to
this. The history of Europe and the United States in the 20th century, I mean, it was kind of dumb for people to do what they did then. And people are not necessarily rational and logical when it comes to attacking other nations.
Is there sort of a, I don't know, an ethical, are there ethical rules about this kind of thing?
Well, it depends on what your definition of ethics is. There's a sense of fairness and fair play, and it's considered to be poor form to invite somebody to visit your village and then mercilessly fall on them and kill them. But they nevertheless do that. Hmm. It's like talking to an alcoholic who got sick and vomited and really hung over the next day, and somebody saying, well, you should learn your lesson. I bet you won't do that again. Well,
yeah. Now, part of the fascination of your story is because it would seem to get to one of the enduring mysteries that we have, which is, what were our ancestors like?
Well,
5,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago.
I'm still fighting that battle, because anthropology and most of the social sciences are divided on this deep philosophical issue about the nature of man and the state of nature. And because part of the history of anthropology has endorsed the noble savage idea that people in a state of nature are, you know, running through the forest with shining, glistening bodies, perfumed flowers in their hair, altruistically doing whatever they can to help their neighbors. Well, it's not that kind of world out there. And for the longest time, anthropology has denied the importance of biology and the evolution of the human organism, because they study culture. And elaborate attempts have been made throughout the history of anthropology to separate human beings from biology, because humans have souls and believe in spirits and things of that sort.
Now, I mean, this sounds like a Darwinian story.
Is it
what
is.
You've been describing. I mean, it's if the wars are basically fought over women, over you know, access to sexual reproduction.
Right. I mean, they fight for reproductively useful or utilitarian goals, not just gold and diamonds, as some of my colleagues would say. They're fighting over women. Gold and diamonds, I can understand, but women, never. The thing that I brought to the attention of my colleagues was there is such a thing as human nature and the evolved organism that we're studying, man, is a product of evolution from higher primates. And the dimensions of that effect on behavior of all primates is a natural history. And one of the most horrible crimes I committed was a publication in the journal Science, one of the most respected journals in the community of academics who are scientists. It includes biology, chemistry, physics, but also anthropology as a science. And one of the articles I published was about Yanomami warfare. And what I found after collecting all of these genealogies and demographic facts and statistics was that men who had killed people, enemies in other villages, had 2.5 times as many wives and 3 times as many children as men their own age who were not killers. And this was offensive to a lot of anthropologists, and many people have, since that publication in 1988, attempted with ingenious different arguments to undo that argument.
Well, and it's striking that, I mean, you have very vocal admirers, including some of the biggest names in science.
Yeah, that's
Steven
true.
Pinker, E.O.
Right.
Wilson.
Right.
I mean, it's striking that a lot of them are either evolutionary psychologists or evolutionary biologists.
But they are all evolutionary biologists.
Right. But when you get to cultural anthropology, they tend not to like you.
No, they don't. But that's changing. I was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2012. A year later, which was just this spring, I was inducted into the National Academy of Sciences. And in a very public, dramatic statement from one of my former professors at the University of Michigan, Marshall Solins, who is now at the University of Chicago, resigned publicly and openly and made a big ceremony out of it because I had been elected to the National Academy of Sciences. He had been elected, you know, 20 years earlier. And the whole point was that he was very much opposed to evolutionary biology or the whole idea of a human nature that was anything other than a cultural nature, and he still is.
Napoleon Chagnon's latest book about the Yanomami Indians of the Amazon is called The Noble Savage. Steve Paulson talked with him. Coming up, don't give up on us yet. There's good news ahead. We humans may be argumentative and warlike by nature, but we're actually becoming more peaceful. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. This hour, we're exploring the heart of darkness, our human propensity for violence, And this has been a pretty depressing hour so far. The underlying message seems to be that the world is a dangerous place and other people will hurt you. And we're surrounded by those stories, right? They're in the news all the time. But historian Steven Pinker told Steve Paulson that the truth is, no matter what you hear in the news, we humans are actually becoming less violent.
In terms of reducing day-to-day violence, both the insult that escalates into a lethal quarrel or the raiding of a neighboring village to abduct the women and kill the men, that has been driven down by the control of government. When you've got a third party that wants to keep the peace within its kingdom, not for any particularly benevolent reasons, but just because violence among citizens is kind of a nuisance to a king who'd rather keep them alive to supply him with taxes and soldiers. But that pacification of a population will drive violence down. And then as a government evolves to a more democratic form, you have the government acting as a third-party dispute resolver through the court system and laws. And instead of having to defend your interests the way the Corleones did by the threat of violence carried out to make it credible, you call the police, you file a lawsuit, and that results in fewer bodies on the floor.
So you're saying it's partly the rise of the nation state. This has contributed to the decline of violence.
Certainly the rise of the state. Yes, states and empires, not necessarily nation states. But the rise of government tends to reduce the rate of lethal quarreling among its citizens. There's also the rise of instruments of commerce, money, contracts, interest, technologies of trade like roads and canals that make it more valuable to buy and sell what you want than to plunder it. And there are a number of reasons to think that the rise of commerce has led to a decline in warfare and violence. Also, I think the rise of education and literacy and cosmopolitanism and knowledge and open free speech have tended to drive down forms of institutionalized violence, partly because people get into the habit of seeing the world from other people's point of view. And the rise of a general intellectual attitude towards social practices. Can we justify what we're doing, or do we have to defend it in argument? And do the people in power have to defend what they do? When you start to have widespread literacy, a free press, people will start to question whether slavery can really be justified or mutilating people as a form of punishment.
Okay, you've mentioned a whole bunch of things here, and I want to sort of pick up a few of them. Coming back to the state, the government, which now often has more power than it used to in previous years, it seems that you could make a different argument, which is that with the rise of the nation state, it is actually much easier to engineer mass killings. Nazi extermination of the Jews or Chairman Mao's eradication of his political enemies during the Cultural Revolution. In other words, maybe there are less frequent violent outbursts, but when they do happen, they're deadlier.
They can be, although it's misleading. If you're talking about the effect of government as a whole over the course of history, and there have been thousands of them, to pick the two or three worst ones gives you a misleading picture of the role of government in general compared to anarchy.
It seems that there is a profound philosophical question at the heart of this, and that is whether we become better human beings, better in terms of being more compassionate, because of our powers of reason, of sort of, you know, coming up with rational underpinnings for moral codes, or whether we act kindly towards other people for more emotional reasons, perhaps because we have been led to think this way through religious upbringing.
You're right that there is an interesting back and forth between the head and the heart, if you will. That is, do we refrain from cruel and destructive practices because we have compassion and empathy for the victims, or because we have a commitment to ideas like universal human rights that don't justify or don't permit the exploitation of other living things. It's very hard to know which came first, but I do think they go back and forth and they can reinforce each other. I don't think it can just be empathy, because quite frankly, I don't think that anyone can literally feel the pain of everyone else on Earth. Maybe I'm a bad person, but I just don't spend that many hours of the day imagining what it's like to be a starving person in South Asia or a victim of war in Africa. On the other hand, I firmly believe that anything that we can do to alleviate hunger and war ought to be implemented. I think that there's no other position can be defended morally, and I'm willing to put it into practice in terms of support for policies, charitable donations. Historically, you see moralistic arguments like how awful it was to be a slave and have a child pulled out of his mother's arms by a cruel slaveholder. But you can also have arguments saying, what right does one person have to own another person? I think they've both been influential. If anything, I would tend to put my bets on the intellectual side, the power of ideas, that one often sees in the history of the abolition of barbaric practices, that it started with briefs from philosophers of the day that then went viral. The pamphlets were distributed, the books sold out, they were translated into every other European language. They were the subject of arguments in the coffee houses and bars and salons and dinner tables, and eventually influenced the decision makers. They probably needed a push of compassion, of sympathetic imagination. What is it like to be an animal who is mistreated? What is it like to be a slave? But the ideas definitely had a huge, powerful influence.
Are you saying humanity is making moral progress? I mean, we're basically becoming better as a species?
Yeah, not that we're, I don't think we've become biologically any better. I don't think that this is a case of Darwinian evolution. But I think our collective global culture has been moving in that direction.
And to speculate into the future then, I mean, if you are right and we are becoming kinder, more compassionate, do you think our moral codes will develop even further?
I suspect they will in many directions. I think that our treatment of farm animals is going to improve. I think that violence against women and children worldwide is going to get better now that it's the target both of shaming campaigns from above and grassroots pressure from below. I think the tolerance of despots and brutal dictators is going to lessen. I think the idea of war between developed countries, which is already pretty much on the way out, is going to become consolidated. That still leaves a number of forms of violence that could still occur. There could still be civil wars. There could still be terrorism. There could still be crime. But to the extent that we can control things by our own decisions, such as the treatment of farm animals, I think that the humanitarian currents will continue.
Steven Pinker. If you want to know more about his argument, we recommend his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Steve Paulson talked with him. In this hour, we've been talking about the heart of darkness. And before we leave the subject, I've been rereading some of Maya Angelou's poetry. And there's one poem in particular that seems to fit what we've been talking about. It's a long poem, but I want to read part of it. We, this people, on this small and drifting planet, whose hands can strike with such abandon that in a twinkling, life is sapped from the living. Yet those same hands can touch with such healing, irresistible tenderness that the haughty neck is happy to bow and the proud back is glad to bend. Out of such chaos, of such contradiction, we learn that we are neither devils nor divines. When we come to it, we, this people, on this wayward floating body, created on this earth, of this earth, have the power to fashion for this earth a climate where every man and every woman can live freely, without sanctimonious piety, without crippling fear. When we come to it, we must confess that we are the possible. We are the miraculous, the true wonder of this world. That is when, and only when, we come to it. A Brave and Startling Truth by the poet Maya Angelou. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, Bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hello, my name is David Mitchell. I'm author of Cloud Atlas and The Bone Clocks. And the book I would like to recommend is Independent People by Haldor Laxness. Many of you may not have heard of this. It's a novel by an Icelandic novelist, Haldor Laxness. He's the only Icelander, I believe, ever to have been awarded the Nobel for literature in this case, and it's richly deserved. This book is about the life of a farmer in a very remote part of this remote country, and it's just fabulous. It's somewhat old school in construction. It's a no-tricks novel, at least on the surface. It's pretty naturalist, realist. It is shot through with references to and channelings of Icelandic myth, but by and large, the laws of physics do not get broken. Its protagonist, a farmer, as a young man, sets up a homestead, a farm, in this somewhat cursed valley. There was a farm there, but it failed to prosper, but he's gone back and is going to pour his will and his life into making this work. It's about the woman and actually women he marries and the children they raise and the changing times of Iceland from, I think, about the 1890s, when Iceland was still very much a third world country, through boom time in the First World War, when the war created a huge demand for both meat and wool, and these serfs became relatively rich for the first time in their lives. It runs through the political movements of the age, the pitfalls they fall into. It's got one really memorable set piece where the characters, it's almost as if Laxness sort of tried to make the most impossible narrative cul-de-sac to get out of. It's a whole scene set in Iceland, in this remote valley, in winter, they haven't seen the sun for ages, in the pre-dawn thorough darkness. A character's just lying there in bed, doesn't even get out of bed. You know, how can you possibly make that interesting? But for about six pages, Laxness makes it brilliant. And then there's a piece in the Icelandic spring towards the end of the novel when one of the farmer's sons is due to set sail to America, which in those days was like leaving for the moon, except further, because you could see the moon from Iceland. It was definitely a one-way ticket, but just as he's about to get onto the boat, he meets this girl, and there's this best sort of exhilarating, they're on horses that go riding. It's an astonishing piece of writing, and hairs on my forearms are standing up just thinking about it now. That's a great, great scene in a book full of great scenes. It's a beautiful piece of art, and it deserves the widest possible audience.
David Mitchell recommends Independent People by Haldor Laxness. And you can find more bookmarks and an interview with Mitchell on our website at ttbook.org. It's time for On Our Minds. And you know what's on my mind? Winter. It's February in Wisconsin. It was 0 degrees when I woke up this morning. I'm tired of being cold. And chances are you are too, because it has been a long, frigid winter just about everywhere. You know what's really annoying? Some people like it. Meet Bill Strever. He's a biologist and a cryophile. He loves the cold. Steve Paulson talked with him about his book called, you guessed it, Cold.
You actually start your book by describing what it was like to dive into Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, 300 miles north of the Arctic Circle, wearing only your swimming suit when the water temperature was 35. I have to say, that sounds pretty cold.
You know, and that's what seems to excite people, is this guy dives into this freezing cold water. But diving in, that's actually, you know, not that unusual for people that come to Alaska, and even for some Alaskans, but certainly tourists that go up to the North Slope. They love the idea and sometimes the actuality of jumping into the ice-cold water of the Arctic as kind of a polar bear plunge sort of a sport. But what I did was a little bit differently, because I plunged in and then stayed in for 5 minutes. I wanted to see what it was like to begin experiencing cold water hypothermia, in part for the book, but also the main reason I did it was because I do work around the water, and there's always a possibility of falling over the side. I wanted to know what that would feel like if I fell over the side. I wanted to know what it would be like to get control of the gasp reflex. So as soon as you hit that cold water, you're unconsciously starting to gasp. And that gasp reflex kills a lot of people. They hit the water, they start to gasp, they get a lung full of water, and they drown. And it started this reputation of very cold water as something that kills people in minutes. And usually if people die in minutes, they're dying from drowning because they gasp in a chest full of that very cold water.
So if you don't actually gasp, what starts happening to your body? Did you feel it shutting down?
Oh, yeah. You feel your at least for me anyway, I feel like my skin is being shrink-wrapped, and you can feel your muscles tightening and your capillaries and your extremities are starting to shut down. And the gasp reflex goes away pretty quickly. So as long as you can keep your head above water for as little as 30 seconds or a minute, you can get past that gasp reflex and regain control of yourself for a while. And then slowly different things start to happen. And it depends a little bit on what you're wearing. But before too long in water that cold, your muscles start to cramp. So if you're not wearing a life preserver, then you would drown. And if you are wearing a life preserver, eventually your muscles are cramped and you're more or less incapacitated. But you can last quite a long time as long as your head is held up above water.
Now, there are two major cold weather hazards we tend to hear about. One is hypothermia. The other is frostbite. And they're really two very different things, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Totally different things. Hypothermia is the cooling of your body temperature, the cooling of your core temperature. Frostbite is the actual freezing of your extremities or the skin in your face, your ears, your nose, your fingers, your toes. It's truly freezing, so the liquids in your body are freezing. They're turning to ice crystals. Those crystals are destroying cell membranes and tissues and possibly not killing you as a person, because you could have a foot totally lost to frostbite and amputated and still certainly survive. So it's a very different thing than hypothermia. Also, it does have to be below freezing for frostbite to occur, because it is freezing the liquids in your body.
Now, there are a number of stories, famous stories, of people who have braved extreme cold, and certainly the most famous stories are the polar explorers, especially those guys who went down to the South Pole. You have scoured this literature, clearly. Do you have favorite explorers or favorite stories?
My favorite explorers are always the guys who were ready to turn around when they realized that things weren't going as they had planned or as they had hoped. They were ready to turn around and bail out and save themselves and their companions.
Ernest Shackleton, for instance.
Shackleton, he turned around more than once, and quite famously once, and I don't remember the exact quote, but I think he wrote something to his wife along the lines of, "I'd rather be a live donkey than a dead lion," meaning that he'd rather be alive and considered a coward than be brave and dead, as many other explorers were.
And the thing to remember is he got really close to the South Pole. He was, 97 miles away when he turned back in 1909?
Yeah, something like that. That's right. It's tough. Anybody that does any kind of exploration work, it's very tough to maintain the drive of an explorer. You're a very goal-oriented person. You want to do something. But to balance that against reality and your own limitations and being able to say it's time to turn around, or even having a plan in place that says, if this set of conditions occurs, we're turning around. And I can't tell you how many times, and I wouldn't consider myself an explorer, but various things I've been involved in where there was a plan to turn around if these conditions occurred. And then those conditions occur, and people stand around debating whether or not they should stick around and stick to their plan, or whether or not they should keep going, which to me is just madness. If you have a plan, stick to it. You made that plan for a reason, and it's time to turn around.
What was the hardest part of these polar explorations? Was it just dealing with all that cold for so many weeks, or is it running out of supplies? What was hardest?
You know, one theme that comes through in the journals and memoirs of many of the explorers is that the hardest part is the planning. And I think that says a lot for the personalities of explorers. These are people that want to go out and do something. They want to be out there on the ice, on the snowpack, whatever. They want to be out there in the action. And yet these explorations required years of planning, years of finding financial backers, years of screening out potential candidates as companions. Very tough stuff to do. And, you know, I think all too often people that aren't familiar with Arctic exploration or exploration in general, they think that the big skill sets are the skill sets of how to move across the snow, how to move across the ice, how to climb a mountain. But really, a big part of the skill sets were around leadership.
For those people who didn't make it during those polar expeditions, or who almost died but then managed to survive, how did they describe those final days or the days near death? I mean, was impending death very painful, or was it actually not so bad as the cold really set in?
I don't think I would ever describe it as not so bad, but one of the common threads that you see in the journals that are salvaged from people who have died is apathy. So as people are gradually dying, they're, of course, constantly cold and they're running out of food, so they're also starving at the same time as their body temperature is slowly dropping. So all these things are going on at once, and people are becoming increasingly apathetic. So I think that might tone down, to some degree, their suffering. The other thing you see, so it's apathy on the one hand, but it's what I think of as the stiff upper lip on the other hand. As Scott tells it, it seemed all very British, the stiff upper lip. Sure, we're suffering, but we're okay with that. Let's have a cup of tea if we can thaw it out.
Now, there are probably some people who think global warming may not be such a bad thing, especially if they live in Alaska or some other very cold place. But you don't feel that way, do you?
Well, not really. You know, there's always this group of, there's always deniers, of course, climate change deniers. We all know them. But there's this other fringe group. I call them Alaskans for Global Warming. And, you know, it's easy to say in the depths of winter up here, and our winter even in Anchorage runs on the long side. And it's easy to say, man, I wish global warming would hurry up and get here so I could get out of this winter mode of living that I'm in now.
Bill Strever is a biologist and a cryophile. Steve talked with him about his book, Cold: Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. So while you're waiting for the world to thaw out and winter to end, here's a suggestion. Curl up indoors with To the Best of Our Knowledge. Subscribe to the podcast, download 9 or 10 hours, and let us keep you company while you wait for spring. You'll find us on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search for To the Best of Our Knowledge. Our program comes to you from the frozen tundra of Wisconsin and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show before heading out to see the frozen ice caves on Lake Superior. He'll post some photos on our Facebook page if he ever unthaws. The rest of the team is Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, Doug Gordon, and Sarah Nix. Steve Mullen from Walk West Music wrote our theme music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening, and stay warm.
PRI, Public Radio International.